Welcome into You're the Cure right here on AM 580 with Dr. Ben Edwards, MD. Check out the website veritasmedical.com. That's veritasmedical.com. Right here on the program, of course, Dr. Edwards, Melody Wilkes, health coach. Glad to see both of y'all all back on the show. Good morning, everybody.
Good morning, everybody. Good to be here.
Yeah. It's always fun. Always a good time. And, of course, along the way, if you have any questions today on the show, feel free to give us a call at any time at 806-745-5800. You can call or text that number, 806-745-5800. But we have Morley back with us, right?
Yes, sir. Morley Robbins, for those of you who don't know. Morley and I have had a long discussion, I think 8 or 9 shows we did over the courses of the summer and the fall.
Yeah.
Diving into all things root cause, trying to get to the very root cause of all this disease that we're seeing that we used to not see. Pre-World War II, we're the healthiest. Now we're the sickest as far as countries in the industrialized countries go. So Morley has really helped broaden and deepen our understanding of how all this biochemistry works and why we're all sick, how we could all have such high cholesterol and such a low vitamin D, which, if y'all remember, vitamin D comes from cholesterol, so there's an automatic big question mark right there. How could we all be low vitamin D if it's made from cholesterol, but we all have high cholesterol? So there's just a few questions that are lingering when you don't go deeper, when you stay to the superficial level, as unfortunately we kind of do in modern medicine, Western medicine. We stay too superficial, treat symptoms instead of diving down to root causes. So listeners, I encourage you to go and continue to listen to those, I think 9 shows. Over and over and over, so you get a deeper understanding, because you are the cure, and even your doctor doesn't know I would hazard a guess they don't know the information that we've been discussing the past few months with Morley, simply because we weren't taught in med school, for sure. After medical school, you get taught by continuing medical education conferences, and I'm pretty sure Morley hasn't been at any of those, and you get taught by drug reps that come into your office pretty routinely. With some nice charts and graphs and pie charts that show 50% reduction of heart attack when you take Crestor. But when you really look at the study, it was only a 0.41% reduction. So when can 50% equal 0.41%? Is when you're a pharmaceutical rep. And I'm going to dive deeper into that thing. First Tuesday night talks, we started this thing at Veritas. Last month was our first one. Was very successful. Facebook Live, that was my first Facebook Live event. 4 or 5,000 people watched that. But the first Tuesday, that's tomorrow. So we'll do our second talk, and I'm going to get into that exact thing, how these statistical gymnastics occur, and even on the front page of USA Today and New York Times and the Wall Street Journal, you'll see these headline articles, 36% reduction in heart attack when it was really 1%. So we'll go over some math to show you how they get to that conclusion. But that was a little bit of a tangent and a plug for tomorrow's night's talk. It'll be on Facebook Live also. But the point of that being superficialness, we're too superficial in our understanding and our treatment of all this epidemic of chronic disease. And you would think we would have budged on some of these disease rates as far as treatment, you know, achieving some sort of remission or reversal or improvement. But everything's just going up and up and up and up. As far as disease rates go, even kids, we've talked about almost 50% of the kids have a chronic disease now. So anyways, first Tuesdays is my talk at Veritas. First Mondays, we're going to have Morley join us again on the radio to do Q&A is the idea for listeners that are diving into this with us. Kind of collect your questions over the month, and every first Monday, Morley and I will take questions. We didn't give anybody a heads up today, so we may just ask our own questions. We've got Melody here. I think she has a few questions.
But never at a loss for questions.
But I did want to maybe review Morley, probably the, one of the biggest, if not the biggest topics, at least from our perspective, but I think from a lot of people's perspective, we went real deep into the detail of this anemia thing, because for new listeners, basically in a nutshell, oxidative stress, that's all the inflammatory stuff happening in the body that's associated with all these diseases, but oxidative stress is triggered by too much iron in the tissue of your body, not enough magnesium and copper. And that's pretty much it, those three minerals right there. You need more mag and copper that's available, bioavailable we call it, and you need less iron. But a lot of people think they're anemic, or they're told they're anemic, which is simply means iron's not in the blood, absent from the blood, anemia. And that can be true, it may not be in the blood, but it's in the tissue. So I wanted to review that topic because it is, it can be a little complicated, and so many people are so stuck and entrenched in the mindset of anemia and iron will help me and all that kind of thought process. So Morley, good morning. Welcome back. It's been a little while since you've been here. We're glad to have you back.
Absolutely. Glad to be here.
Of course, we can talk about anything you want to talk about also today, but I thought we'd do just a brief review, and this is partly triggered by I was reviewing a video that Morley and I had done recently that was going through the editing process, and I heard the clip about the anemia and how doctors used to measure iron level in the body just by looking at hemoglobin, which is part of the red blood cell, the part that carries your oxygen around the body. 70% of the body's iron is in hemoglobin, in this red blood cell. So that's a significant portion. So doctors use that to estimate or guesstimate our iron levels in the body. Just look at hemoglobin. So from the Civil War till basically 1972, that's what doctors knew. They associated hemoglobin with iron. And that hemoglobin molecule is also made of heme. There's four heme that are attached together to carry that iron, carry the oxygen. But those heme molecules have to be put together, knitted together by copper, or an enzyme that relies on copper. So, Morley, I just kind of wanted to review that whole process. So if you don't mind, I kind of gave the real snippet of it there, I guess, but talk about a little more some of the in-depth, maybe some of those articles. I think it was, you said, Dr. Krebs and Warburg back in the 20s when they first started looking at this with birds and bleeding these birds out, and what they found was not what they expected to find. But maybe refresh our memory on that.
Yeah, I think what's happened is we all are familiar with revisionist history, how things have changed over time to be more acceptable. Well, I think there's revisionist metabolism that's taking place on the planet. It's like when we go back in time, there were some really important luminary scientists and clinicians like Otto Warburg and Hans Krebs who were really delving into two minerals. They were obsessed with copper and iron, which is amazing when you think about it. I mean, we don't think of people of that stature. You know, Warburg was nominated a modest 46 times for the Nobel Prize between 1923 and 1942. He only got one in 1931, in large part because Hitler thought one was enough and wouldn't let him get another. Part of it was that Warburg was Jewish. But Hitler also knew how brilliant he was, so he wasn't about to send him off to the camps. Basically, what Hitler wanted Warburg to do was solve cancer, because Hitler's mother died of breast cancer, and Hitler had a polyp on his throat, and he thought he was going to have throat cancer. That's not a lot of people know that historical perspective, but Warburg was a protected scientist during the war, and did amazing research, and then one of his proteges was Hans Krebs, brilliant scientist, who went on to get the Nobel Prize in 1954 for developing what's called the Krebs cycle. But the research that you're referring to was in 1927 in Dr. Warburg's lab in Berlin. They bled birds almost to the point of death, to create absolute anemia. So that really, there truly was low iron in the blood. It was because the blood was pretty much gone from the birds. And what they were looking for was what will happen with copper and iron in the blood as a response to that shock to the system. And what surprised them, I think what it must have unnerved them, was that there was a six-fold increase in copper proteins in the blood. And on the surface, that doesn't make sense because we've all been conditioned like lab rats to think blood equals iron. And what's this copper thing? Oh, it's cause of toxicity, isn't it? And so people have been trained to think a certain way, which is 180 degrees from the truth. But what Warburg and Krebs revealed was that blood metabolism, heme metabolism, iron metabolism are all dependent on bioavailable copper. And it's on the surface, it's like, huh? How could that be? And the way I describe it for folks is that when you really step back from the literature and really have a grasp of what the research has revealed over the last 100 years, is that the dynamic between copper and iron is like a ventriloquist act. And iron is the dummy. Copper is this incredibly important, again, orders of magnitude. It takes 100 milligrams of copper to run the human body. On average, there's about 5,000 milligrams of iron in the human body. And then to round it out with our other favorite mineral, it's about 130,000 milligrams of magnesium. So you begin to get a sense of the orders of magnitude about how different their levels are, but it also begins to suggest the impact that 100 milligrams has over 5,000 milligrams. It's actually kind of mind-numbing when you step back from it. But the point is, that has all been swept under the rug. And even though Warburg got the Nobel Prize in 1931 for discovering what's called the respiratory enzyme, well, we know that today is complex 4 of the mitochondrial electron transport chain. What's complex 4 all about? It's where oxygen gets hooked up with some electrons and hydrogen to make water, so that will release the precursor to ATP. It's called ADP. Goes over to complex 5 to make 3 energy molecules. And they're spelled magnesium-ATP inside the cell. Well, that complex 4 runs on copper. And what they love to talk about in the literature is that the complex 4, there's two heme in it. There is a heme A and a heme A3. But what they forget to tell us is that you can't make heme A and you can't make heme A3 unless you have bioavailable copper. So the fact that there are 3 known copper atoms in that complex, plus the heme that requires copper, they want us to think that it's a heme group, therefore iron is controlling it, when in fact, iron is like a fan in your room. It doesn't work until you turn it on. And it doesn't work unless there's electrons going through the copper wire to the fan. And that's exactly how complex 4 works. Gotta have copper. And the thing is, it's almost disorienting to try to get people to see the truth because they've been so conditioned to believe that iron runs the body. And it's a constant process of kind of teasing people back off the ledge and get them to realize that, in fact, if they would just focus on restoring the bioavailability of their copper by eating organ meats, by focusing on bee pollen, by having whole food vitamin C, maybe by eating cashews that are grown in a proper soil, that suddenly, or here's one that surprised me over the weekend. I learned how Captain Cook kept his sailors alive during three circumnavigations around the globe. He had thousands of pounds of sauerkraut in barrels. And it turns out that when you take cabbage, a cup of cabbage has about 60 milligrams of whole food vitamin C, which is, that's a pretty good amount of vitamin C. That's considered the adult daily dose. When you ferment it, and all you got to do is put sea salt, mix it in with the cabbage, let it sit for a couple days or a couple weeks, and it becomes sauerkraut. Well, that same cup of sauerkraut has 600 milligrams of vitamin C. And Captain Cook lost very few sailors, as opposed to Christopher Columbus, who lost 90% of his crew, and Magellan, who lost 95% of his crew, to scurvy. And so this was a major breakthrough in the advent of sailing, because Captain Cook figured out how to prevent that condition from taking place. And again, whole food vitamin C that was managing the iron that would prevent the oxidation of the collagen, which we are calling scurvy. That's all scurvy is a wound that cannot heal. The collagen can't be knit together with the elastin, and that requires bioavailable copper. And so it's a fascinating process that people just need to be focusing on the right end of the minerals. And yes, there's work that needs to be done to restore magnesium. And yes, there's work that needs to be done to remove the excess iron. But we've got to be really focused on making sure that we're taking the steps to build the whole food vitamin C that has a key enzyme called tyrosinase at the core. And what's hanging out inside that tyrosinase is four copper atoms, which play a very pivotal role in many different transactions in the body. And again, it's these, as you said earlier, Dr. Edwards, these enzymes have mineral cofactors or mineral keys. And if they don't have that copper top battery, they're not going to work. And that's really the magic of the human body, is when there are adequate levels of these minerals and then the right balance with each other, the body really does sing. It's amazing. And we've just lost that perspective because we're probably at least the third, maybe the fourth, our children are the fifth generation to have mineral deficiency in the soil, in the food, and therefore in our body, and we've just taken that's just the way it is, when in fact our ancestors would be shocked at the condition of the food that we take for granted, thinking that it's got all the nutrients that it needs. So it really is on one level, it sounds really complicated, but actually it really isn't. It's like we're coming up into the Christmas season, and there's nothing more disheartening than getting a present. I remember this as a child. I got this incredible model car. It was like a Phaeton. It was like 2 feet long. I was so excited to get it. And then it said, "Batteries not included." I was like, "Huh?" And I had to wait 2 days before I could play with it because the stores were closed. And so, that car is like our enzymes. If the batteries aren't there, if the minerals that provide the energy aren't available, then they don't work. And what I'm also coming to realize, and this is kind of maybe stepping beyond where you were thinking of going, but again, there's a lot of conditioning that's taking place now about genetic problems. Oh, you've got such and such gene defect. And again, I'm not a Luddite. I know that it shows up on these tests, but so many of these problems, like I've got a client who has high homocysteine and low folate, which is B9. And that combination is courtesy of, or so she thinks, courtesy of some gene defects that are causing that. And I was pointing out to her earlier today, did you know that homocysteine rises with copper deficiency? And did you know that that of all the B vitamins, the one that's most connected to copper status is B9. And so I think what's happening is because of the loss of copper in our environment and in our body, genes are in fact expressing, and it appears like a gene defect, when in fact I think it's just a missing battery. I think we're missing batteries in people. And when they start to get that battery back, it changes. And I know it does change because I've talked to nutritionists who've worked with people who have, in fact, corrected so-called gene defects just through nutrition alone. So I think we have to really rethink what is happening as it relates to all of this growth in disease, especially genetic disorders. You know, the rise now of autism, it, you know, in 1930, it was zero. When I was born in 52, one in 10,000. I think, Dr. Edwards, you said when you were born, it was one in 5,000. Well, in 2014, it was one in 45. And just last week, they published a research study saying that in 2016, it's now one in 36. And the projection is that by 2035, it's going to be one in two. Well, people have kind of started grabbing their pitchforks and saying, wait a minute, we're not going to tolerate that. That's not, I think the point that you've made time and time again is that that's not a genetic process. That is an engineered process. That's an environmentally influenced process, and we can stop it. I'm convinced we can stop it because we've got the wherewithal now to understand what's working and what's not working. But this idea that suddenly one in two is going to have autism, that society should be enraged at that. And that's just one condition amongst 100 that we could talk about. So I'll stop there because I know I kind of danced around a lot of things, but hopefully I did answer your question.
Yes, you did. Very well. Gave us a lot to think about, too. Took us right up to our first break, our only break. So let's do that real quick, and we'll come back and follow that great answer up.
Welcome back to You're the Cure right here on AM 580. Of course, don't forget VeritasMedical.com. You can go to the website, check out all the shows we have there, as well as other useful information, VeritasMedical.com. Right back at it with Morley Robbins, who is our special guest this morning on the show. If you have a question along the way, 806-745-5800, text or call in for sure. Back to Dr. Ben Edwards, MD.
Thank you, Wade, and thank you, Morley. I just want to summarize that first segment. I was asking Morley about anemia when the doctor says we're low in iron because we're anemic in our blood, that the iron really is probably in the tissues unless you've bled out a whole lot of blood. The reason the iron's in the tissue, it's because we've been exposed to lots of iron since they fortified the food in the 1940s and on. We've all got plenty of iron. And in one show, Morley talked about how incredibly amazing the iron recycling system is in the body, so that we really just reuse it over and over and over and over. So if we're consuming more over the years, even infant formula is fortified with iron. So if we consume plenty and too much, and then we recycle it really, really well, obviously we're going to have too much, and it gets stored in the tissue. So when your blood, when you do lose some blood, then there's an enzyme that'll get triggered to pull the iron out of your tissue, out of storage, and put it into use in the blood. And that's a copper-dependent enzyme. That's why Warburg and Krebs in the 1920s, that research paper showed when they bled the birds out, what did they see elevate? It was copper proteins, copper dependent enzymes, because those guys were starting to work to move the iron out of the tissue back to make new blood. So you need copper to make new blood. You need copper to move your iron out of your tissue. Iron that's excess iron that's stored drives oxidative stress and inflammation. But you got to have copper there to move it around, get it where it needs to go. Of course, you need copper for so many other things, as Morley started alluding to. One point I want to make before we talk about anything else, though, is ferritin is a blood test that's starting to be drawn and recognized more and more. Doctors are looking at it. And it is, or doctors look at it as a marker of your iron status. But what the research shows is that at best, probably 10% of iron is in the ferritin form, and it's really, ferritin should be an intracellular, inside the cell, storage form of iron. So when you have too much iron, you can store away some extra there for a rainy day in case you get a wound and you bleed a bunch. You'll have some stored iron you can pull from if you have enough copper to pull it. So ferritin should just be stored and locked up inside your cells. And if there's damage to your cells, particularly in the liver, if there's a lot of inflammation because a lot of iron stored in the liver, if there's inflammation and damage in your liver, then the ferritin can actually, the cells can break apart. The ferritin that's inside the cell will come out into the bloodstream, and we can measure it. So I believe Morley quoted Sir Douglas Kell, the world's authority on, mm-hmm. on ferritin and iron. I think it was him that said the normal, quote-unquote, normal level of ferritin in the blood should be zero. We shouldn't see any of it because it should all be inside our cells. So if there's any in the blood, that means there's damage to the cells, the liver cells in particular. So if you got a whole lot of ferritin in your blood, you know, that means there's a whole lot of damage, a whole lot of excess iron that's coming out of your liver. So I don't know if I explained that perfectly well, but Morley, is that about right in line with what you were teaching earlier in one of the shows?
Yeah, no, absolutely. And I think to simplify it, that when we're baking cookies, we're worried about the oven temperature. It needs to be 350. We're not concerned about kitchen temperature. Who cares whether it's 68 or 72? And the ferritin is the oven. You don't walk over to the wall temperature in the kitchen to see if the oven is ready to bake the cookies. It makes no sense. And that's what they're doing day in and day out with the ferritin blood test. It's the wrong medium. And yes, there is a way to measure it inside the cell, but it's real expensive. They're not going to do that for everybody. You know, they do it for lab rats all the time, but they're not going to do it for the two-legged rats. It's too expensive. So people just have to... They need a full panel. I call it the full Monty iron panel. I'm not sure that you've labeled it yet, Dr. Edwards, but I think you're getting a much more complete picture now of how magnesium, zinc, copper, you know, the ferro oxidase enzyme, and all of the different iron markers, how those are all in relationship to each other to determine what is the state of iron homeostasis in this person's body. You know, if that iron homeostasis is a seesaw, one end is iron in the blood, the other end is iron in the tissue, and that fulcrum is that enzyme, ferrooxidase. And when the iron in the blood is too light, like a four-year-old on a seesaw, and the other end is a sumoester, well, then you know that ferrooxidase is not doing its job to shuttle iron between those two ends of the seesaw. And I think what happens to a lot of people is they're told that they are anemic, you know, that implies low iron in the blood. They're missing the other two components of the study of iron homeostasis. They have no idea about how their iron in the tissue is. Again, it's either a very expensive procedure, a T2 MRI, or a very painful procedure, a needle biopsy, you know, you first. And they don't really know that the doctor is, the typical doctor is not measuring the status of that enzyme. And so people are making decisions based on limited information, and it has, as you so aptly phrase it, there are unintended consequences. Because that low iron in the blood, it's another term for it is hypoferemia, literally means low iron in the blood, hypoferemia, and it's a known condition when there's a lot of inflammation in the body, in the tissue. And what did we learn in an earlier conversation? Is that iron activates the inflammasome. We learned that from Nagamura and his colleagues in 2015. You know, they discovered that iron activates a key protein, of the danger sensor of the cell, and that's what activates inflammation. So it's iron in the tissue that's causing the very inflammation that's causing the iron to look low in the blood. And so it's all the optics are backwards from what we think it is. And so people need to really step back from the labels that they're being given. Well, your iron is low, and say, well, what part of the iron? You know, are you just measuring ferritin? Well, that's not a very complete measure. And there really are 9 parts to the full Monty iron panel. That to give proper consideration to someone's iron homeostasis, you need a multi-part assessment, not a grade school, ruler to say is ferritin high or low. That's not being responsible, I don't think, to the elegance and the sophistication of copper iron metabolism.
Yeah. Well, it would seem to me, knowing that we've all lived and eaten American food that's been fortified with iron, really nobody should be truly deficient of iron in their body unless maybe they've really experienced some massive bleeding, sustained, continual, massive bleeding. But even then, if they didn't have enough copper to move iron that was stored in the body, to replace that blood that they lost, I mean, even then I would still question. But so, I mean, it's really, really, really hard to have not enough iron in this day and age. But again, low in the blood versus low in the tissue. So that fulcrum, that seesaw, ferrooxidase, the enzyme that moves the iron from the tissue to the blood, is copper dependent. I just want to remind viewers or listeners of that. And then this anemia that we're talking about, inflammation and anemia, doctors learn, at least I did, the early 2000s when I was in school and residency, anemia of chronic disease. It was kind of this generic term where people had certain chronic diseases of inflammation. If they were anemic, it was just because they had this chronic disease. There was no deeper understanding or explanation of the biochemistry as to why, and also the treatment of it was nothing. And I specifically remember thinking, there's nothing we can do? Because the professor would say, no, my attending physician, oh, that's anemia of chronic disease. Don't give them iron. That's a waste because it's not really going to help. You can if you want to, but it's not going to budget. And so it was pretty much my attending physician and everyone, I mean, standard of care recognized for anemia of chronic disease, there's really nothing you can do about it. It's just the consequence of disease. So people just hung out in this low state of hemoglobin. Now, of course, it makes sense. Well, if we would have given them copper, like Dr. Krebs and Warburg, we could have concluded, if we went back in the 1920s and read that research and synthesized it, we could have proposed that if I was a medical student who was really on point and had time to go read the 1920s literature. Or if I had met Morley earlier, I would have had a really smart answer for that. Anemia of chronic disease, more aptly termed, I would say, as we're discussing it, really should be called anemia of chronic inflammation, because that chronic inflammation is what keeps the enzyme turned off, that copper enzyme that moves your iron out of the tissue into the blood. So it's fascinating. A whole new world.
And just to simplify the message for folks, when the body is low in bioavailable copper, which is a pretty certain state in today's society, in large part because we don't eat organ meats, and that's where copper hangs out in the body, is in organ meats, the liver, the kidney, the heart, the pieces of the animal that we no longer eat because we're repulsed by it. And when copper is low, the body automatically stores iron because it knows it can't move it. So it stores it. And it stores it in the liver first and foremost, and then it starts to work out into the endocrine glands, and then the other organs, especially the organs found in the center of the body, like the stomach, the pancreas, the kidneys. Those are the ones that are most likely to get iron toxic in the beginning, and then as we age, iron's going to go into the joints, and then as we get a little bit older, it's going to become Alzheimer's and Parkinson's and things of that nature. And that's the natural progression of iron overload in the human body. And where is it going to show up? You know, as from day one, as we age, there's a very predictable place that's going to accumulate iron. It's called our eyes, the retina. I think, Dr. Edwards, you've mentioned that the retina turns over every 48 hours. Well, what I learned over the weekend, which kind of surprised me, is that there are three forms of the ferrooxidase enzyme. There's one that's usually found in the liver called ceruloplasmin. There's one in the gut called hephaestin. And there's one in the woman's womb called zyklopent. Not a lot of people have ever even heard that word. You think it's a musical instrument. But ceruloplasmin, hephaestin, and zyklopent are all three found in the retina of the eye, which is mind-blowing. That's how important the management of iron is to the retina. It's not just doubling of effort, it's tripling of effort to make sure that that the iron can get managed. And what are we all being exposed to on toxic levels daily? Blue screens, blue light from our phones, our computer screens, and our TVs. And we're not even thinking about the fact that that blue light is attracting iron, because that's what blue light does. And the other end of the spectrum is called red light, and guess who likes to hang out with red light? It's called copper. And when there's too much blue light, it drowns out the red light. So it's just, I don't know, it's forgive me for getting excited, but it's like the answer is so simple, but it's having to get people to unlearn what they're convinced they already know. As Mark Twain said, you know, it's not what you don't know that gets you into trouble. It's what you know for certain that just ain't so. And what would be fascinating, I would love to be able to talk to your grandfathers and your great-grandfather, who were physicians, and ask them how they measured anemia back in the day. And I know they would have done it with hemoglobin, right? That was the standard of care during the course of their careers. And what they also knew back then was that in order to correct low hemoglobin, they would focus on two things, either beef liver or cod liver oil, because cod liver oil has a very rich level of retinol, and guess what retinol does? Turns into retinoic acid, which then activates the iron regulatory proteins to manage iron status in the body. And so and what are we exposed to today at toxic levels? Vitamin D. And what does vitamin D do? It kills the retinol in our liver. And it's like, wow, it's amazing how in the course of 100 years, the understanding of this vital part of our anatomy has become reversed. It's the complete inverse of what it was 100 years ago. And it's not, and I think the point that you regularly make, Dr. Edwards, is that up until 1945, we were the healthiest nation on the planet. And now, 70 years later, we're the sickest nation on the planet. Well, guess what changed during the course of that time? They started adding iron to the food system. They call it iron fortification. Wink, wink. We're here to help. But no one understood the unintended consequences of what that extra iron was going to do, especially in a body that was compromised with too little magnesium and, even more importantly, too little bioavailable copper. That's how these three minerals have such important connections with each other.
Yeah. Well, and I'm looking at my slide right now from the Journal of the American Medical Association. This was a study they published a few years ago. But the title of the study is Changes in USDA Food Composition Data from 43 Garden Crops from 1950 to 1999. I pulled out just the magnesium and the copper. So this is depletion of minerals in our food from 1950 data to 1999. Celery, this is for copper. I'll just run down a few things with copper. we'll start with lettuce. 0.15 milligrams down to 0.01. From 15 to 0.01. From 1950 to 1999. Parsley, 0.52 down to 0.03. Mustard greens, 0.12 down to 0.01. Radish, 59 milligrams down to 11 milligrams. Turnips, 58 milligrams down to 15. Apples, 21 down to 2. Nectarines, 9.1 down to 1. And celery, 0.11 milligrams down to 0.01. And overall, when you look at all the food crops, it was about 80% reduction in copper in our food. For magnesium, six on cabbage. 1950, a cabbage had 16 milligrams of magnesium. Now it's 6. Carrots, 12 milligrams down to 3. Parsley, 52 milligrams down to 23. Radish, 11 milligrams down to 5. Cantaloupes, 20 milligrams down to 11 milligrams. That's magnesium. From 1950 to 1999. So copper and magnesium, the two things we need the most to make all these enzymes work properly, just completely wiped out of our food. Other minerals have too, but copper by far and away is number one depletion. Magnesium, even if you are able to eat 11 milligrams of magnesium in a cantaloupe in 1999 versus 20. So you have to eat 2 cantaloupes to get that magnesium. But even if you do stress, we haven't really mentioned it this show, we have in other shows, stress causes you to deplete, your body will deplete magnesium. It's called the magnesium burn rate, that is Morley has coined that phrase. So we're definitely under more stress today. So our food has half the amount of mag. We're under probably quadruple the amount of stress. Copper, it's just not there. And you mentioned the organ meats. We're not eating them. That's the other place we find copper. So, I mean, it's the perfect storm. All these three things happening at once. Copper and mag out of our food, or we're just not eating the organ meats. And then iron started to be added into the food in the 1940s. So the perfect storm of these three different things. It's almost as if someone really did understand how the body worked and said, let's figure out a way to make everything not work right. All right, take out mag and copper and add iron. And that's a recipe for disaster.
And I think part of what's hard for people to realize and to really accept is that, well, first of all, people think that minerals are hood ornaments. No, they're actually the keys to start the engine. It's really important. And then they think, well, oh, come on, a little lowly, you know, atom of copper, how important could that be? And it's like, as we're discussing this, I hope people are grabbing the significance of it. And the image that comes to mind is a friend of mine in high school. His name was Steve Waters. And he was like 5'8", very small guy. But he was on the varsity football team for one reason. He was flawless at being able to do a shoelace tackle. If anyone, I'm not a big football guy, but I know how important a shoelace tackle is. What a big runner fears the most is someone who knows how to do that effectively. And Steve Waters would be brought into the game at a critical time when they had to stop the advancing linemen or the advancing plays to get to the end of the field. And that's, Steve Waters was like copper. Little lowly Steve Waters could change the course of the football game because he knew how to stop the advancing players on the other field. He was really feared as a player. And he was one of the smallest people on the team. So it's just, people need to really rethink how simple this disease process really is. And there's a reason why I say there really is no medical disease, because I now know that it's all metabolic dysfunction that's caused by mineral dysregulation. And I think what we've teased out in the course of these 9 or 10 conversations is that, you know, when you got too much iron in your body, you're going to get mineral dysregulation. And then you start the cascade of the breakdown of the enzymes that then lead to symptoms that then get lassoed by a doctor and you're told you have XYZ disease. Well, they slap a label on it, but it's not a disease. It really does not exist. And I'm not being insensitive to the listeners who have notable labels, that they've got to really step back and rethink, maybe there's a part of this process that I didn't understand, and it needs to be rethought, reassessed, and that's what the Veritas Medical Group is all about, is really rethinking what this process is and how do we retool it. I think what's going to be important in a subsequent show is just to talk about some of the surprising clinical advances that have been made by applying these principles. I think the listeners would find that fascinating
yeah.
to see that some of these folks who've had really notable metabolic knots, they're untying and they're getting their life back.
Yeah.
I think people need to know that it actually works. It's not just theoretical, but there's clinical application on 50th Street where it's taking place.
Yeah, I agree. There's some amazing testimonials that we're starting to see now that we're a few months into remineralizing people appropriately. I just want to throw in at the very end here, because it's in the news, you know, this Aetna-CVS merger, Obamacare, and or is a tax reform going to affect the mandate, individual mandate on health insurance? And I mean, I'm giving a talk later this week at Lubbock Children's Home specifically just to inform them about some different healthcare options, these health share groups, private membership clinics like mine at Veritas. A local church contacted me that they have a number of employees, fairly large church. They're discussing different health benefit, healthcare options. And we're going to have a meeting next week about that also. But it's just in the news. And what I really want to stress to people is get off the sinking ship of, I mean, that Aetna, CVS thing, who knows where that's going to end up. But you don't even really have to concern yourself with that whole deal with sick care, you know, the expensive, unaffordable health insurance plans if you're business owners. That whole model isn't the best model. I'm going to submit to you to consider that if you get to the root cause of a problem, which is what we're talking about here, by getting the minerals balanced properly, then inflammation goes down, and the consequences of inflammation that we label all these different things, from fibromyalgia to hypertension to arthritis to you name it, these are all diseases of inflammation. So if you can really get to the root of inflammation and deal with that, then a lot of the smoke from the fire goes away. You don't have to be so concerned with this health insurance and what's your copay going to be and your deductible going to be to get to your five different specialists that you have to go see and your 10 pharmaceutical prescriptions you're on and et cetera, et cetera. Deal with the root cause, and then symptoms of inflammation can go away. Then you can just, you know, buy something more affordable, which again we've talked about before. These health shares, Christian health share groups, have very affordable things to help share medical costs, more for catastrophic stuff. They don't cover pre-existing, and they don't cover long-term pharmaceuticals. So it fits perfectly with someone who wants to get to the root cause of their pre-existing and try to fix it, reverse it. So there's lots of hope out there. There's lots of bright stuff on the future. If you know where to look, continue to listen to this show, continue to steward your own health, get educated yourself, you be the cure. Because unfortunately the system is not set up very well at all to teach doctors how to help you get well. We learn how to manage chronic disease, and we can only manage it with a few tools in our toolbox. We're taught a lot of pharmacology, so we have pharmaceuticals in our toolbox. We're taught a little bit of surgery, and so that's in a surgeon's toolbox. And that's about it. Just like I said, the anemia of chronic disease, there was no treatment for it. The iron wouldn't really help, so we just did nothing. So find a doctor who can get to the root cause of stuff, and partner with that doctor. And what he's going to turn around and tell you is it's diet and lifestyle. I mean, that's all on the patient. You're going to have to fix your diet and your lifestyle. You're going to have to remineralize. We can help walk you through that process, but mainly it's going to be educating you and convincing you and renewing your mind to believe this is actually true. So, and just encourage everybody to continue to listen. Go listen to previous shows. Come to my talk, First Tuesday Talks, every month. So I'll be doing it tomorrow night at Veritas, 1802 East 50th and MLK, or it's on Facebook Live. We'll continue to bring Morley in to just educate us more and more to this deeper understanding. So thank you all for joining us today. And Morley, thank you very much for being with us today. We didn't get many questions. Sorry, Melody.
We heard a lot from the health coach today on this show.
I had a question, but I'll ask Dr. Edwards afterwards.
Next time, we'll do testimonials from my clinic, and then we'll do questions from the audience.
I'm learning. I'm listening. I'm writing down.
Yes, you are. You've gone through a whole mead pad over there of stuff, of notes, which is all good, right?
Well, you can't hear this too much when the culture out there and your doctors and everybody, the news is not fully educated. You're going to be hearing a lot of half-truths. So it's good to go over this over and over and over and drive it home.
No doubt.
Thank you, Morley.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Happy to be a part of it, and I appreciate the opportunity to share these insights.
You bet, Morley. Again, check out gotmag.org or like us on Facebook as well. Right?
Yeah. Yes.
Okay.
Magnesium Advocacy Group.
Yes.
That's right.
What you said.
Magnesium Advocacy Group on Facebook. Morley, thanks a lot.
There's always room for one more. Always room for one more on Mag Group. Absolutely.
Morley, thanks again. We appreciate it. Look forward to having you back on the show with You're the Cure right here on AM 580. Have a wonderful rest of the week, sir.
You as well. Okay. Right. Thanks so much. You guys have a great day.
All right, till next time, we'll see you back here next Monday on You're the Cure, of course, brought to you by Veritas Medical. Check out the website, veritasmedical.com. We'll be right back with Unconfused right here on AM 580.